Lost and Rewound on Radio Free Brooklyn. I am Jimmy.
And I am Alon.
Time to get embarrassed with us.
Welcome, listener. For all intents and purposes, consider this our first episode. If you have gotten to know us through the original podcast, consider this, I don't know, like episode 24 or something like that.
The premise is simple. The results are complex. If you have an audio tape from the old days that's still attainable, we want to hear it. Be it a mixtape, an assignment from school, or just messing around with friends on the bus, your audio is paramount to our mission. Uncover the sounds of old, so we can remain in touch with our former, younger selves. Perhaps each week we learn a little something. Who knows? At least we hope to reminisce a bunch without getting too nostalgic. Lost or Rewound is all about the objective retrospective.
A quick refresher, though. 1994, this was the year in which I transitioned between 5th and 6th grade. During these grades, I spent a large chunk of time carrying around a handheld tape recorder, recording everything that my friends had to say within close proximity. The Danziger Zone was my first foray into documenting the world around me in real time. These tapes amassed to a total of 50 tapes by the time 1996 came to a close, and they do continue to serve as the basis for this program. So it would come to pass that through my travels, I've discovered other audio time capsules, like that of my own. And on this episode, we'll check out some clips that we haven't heard yet from the days of Woodstock Elementary. But first, this.
You need some dehydrating drinking water. Just add water. Never mind.
New steps, like the one-legged gribble. And new singers, like Vegetarian Loaf.
Now would do anything for love.
We would be remiss if we were not to address the metaphorical elephant in the room before we begin on the bulk of what Lost and Rewound is all about, and that is the tapes. But unfortunately, I feel a little like I have to take this weight off my shoulders because this metaphorical elephant is just like dying to get off. So tell me, Jimmy Hoffman, where have you been, sir?
Where has he been?
Where has Jimmy Hoffman been?
Is the question on the lips of the masses. Where did he go? Where did Jimmy Hoffman run off to? And the question is actually quite complex. Jimmy Hoffman went on a journey. That's right, a journey. A journey looking for the answers. The answers to what? Not even Jimmy Hoffman knows. But he had to find them. He went searching high, and he went searching higher.
Wait, so, but the topography in Brooklyn doesn't really allow you to go that high,
he
does it?
He got on the hills, my man. He was on hills.
Yo, that's some hills right there.
He was just, I mean, he ascended, and then he didn't descend. He went all the way up to the top of the hill, and he couldn't see the bottom.
It sounds like, from the sounds of your voice, you clearly have been on some journeys, considering the way your voice sounds traveled, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
I think I needed to travel so that I could do the voice justice. The voice needed answers.
Yes.
Why does it sound like this?
Where is mine? It's never changed. I feel like ever since I was 12 years old, my voice has remained this kind of high-pitched, cranky Jewish kid.
I like it, man. I like it, honestly. I do. I feel like if your voice sounded like my voice, it would just be like, I don't know, two old black guys in a room just spitting blues, man.
One of the things that's so interesting about listening to old clips of yourself when you were younger is the one thing I think that always seems to permeate is that it never stops is how – who is that? I can't believe I sound like that. How, you know, who is talking? I don't even know who's talking. They all sound exactly the same.
But I feel like it's really hard to actually have a memory of what your voice sounded like in the past.
Yeah.
Because you are constantly hearing your voice, so you're hearing it constantly change. You don't, you know, have, you don't pick it up one day where you didn't hear yourself for 10 years. People go, oh my God, you sound like this now. You've always heard it. So you're right. Anytime I listen to myself in the past, I'm like, yeah, that was what I sounded like? Seriously?
It's just, yeah, I mean, basically just put your pitch up, you know, a few decibels, I guess a few notches, and yeah, you know, you could be 11 years old all over again. Hi, this is Elon Danziger, and I'm coming to you live from my house. I mean, I can't do it because it's impossible. You can't just revert back to the way your voice sounded. See, at all.
That's the thing. If I had like 50 tapes from when I was like 12 years old, it'd be like, hey, yo, ma, get me some cookies. And you ain't no way I'm going to do nap time.
He was born with the voice of a god, Jimmy Hoffman.
Well, I'll tell this quick story because I've told this on stage, and I don't know if you ever heard it, but I think you probably did.
Mm.
You probably did.
Okay.
So for those of you out there that don't know, I also do some stand-up comedy, and I host a couple of open mics, or, well, at this point, one open mic, hoping to be more open mics. If you'd like to go, it's actually at the Jeet Jet Bar.
Jeet Jet?
Which is
dope food.
I have to spell because just saying that, no one's gonna know what that means.
It's a J apostrophe E A T and then a J E T.
You got it. Question mark.
Question mark. Oh, right. Question of course. Mark. Can't
so
forget the
it's
question mark.
Did Jeet Jet?
Jeet. Yep.
I'm glad that this is actually an audio, you know, medium that we're using, so I can explain. Because if you just read it, people are like, "You're playing in a French place." I know French. That's not French. And I'm like, they should have a little explanation. It should just say, "Did you eat yet?" Underneath.
What kind of performances usually happen at the open mic? Is it all across the board, or is it mostly music?
It is mostly music right now, but we also have stand-up comedy. And we've gotten some poets and some people doing short stories, storytelling.
Mm. Yep.
I'm telling you.
Indeed, indeed.
So if you guys ever wanted to hit that up, that's Sunday nights at 9 p.m. between 20th and 21st Street on 5th Avenue in Brooklyn, South
Slope. So that's what you've been doing. You haven't been climbing mountains. You've just been hosting open mics.
It's a mountain to climb to get through that mic.
Oh, man. For sure. Oh, for sure. So, like, one of the things that you've been telling the people over on your open mics then, you said you had a story about your younger self.
Yeah, so it had to do with my voice, and it had to do with people hearing my voice, you know, being projected. And it's something that I basically do now all the time. You know, I'm always trying to have my voice be recorded, as in right now. But at the same time, I was so young. I was 4 years old, and we'd gone on a school trip to a news station, and we were like little kid newscasters. Which I wish that they'd, like, had the tape of it still. That would have been something to watch,
that
right?
That would have been, yeah, for sure.
4 years old, right?
Absolutely.
So I actually remember hearing this. I was in earshot. I guess it was, like, after I had gone. And my pre-K teacher came over to my mother after I had done my little spiel they gave me to say. They gave me some copy to read. And she goes, this is a little weird, but your son has a really sexy voice. And I was 4 years old.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I didn't really know how to feel, because I was four. But I'll tell you, pre-K was never the same.
No, would it? I mean, I don't know if I would ever know what. I don't even know if I knew what the word sexy was until I got to be around middle school.
I knew it was a good thing.
you were exposed to the goodness of sexiness.
I was special. I was like, yeah, all right. Extra cookie during snack time, you know. You'd be in the sandbox flexing.
You still have tapes, though, in general, though, don't you?
I do.
You're going to have to contribute, dude. Come on, put up or shut up, for real.
Yeah, we've got decks and we've got all kinds of things. We'll make this happen. We'll make this happen. I found, and this is going to be coming soon, guys, I got to say I'm 5 years old on the tape.
Mm.
And it is this mystery we did, like a Hardy Boys sort of thing, me and my buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely listened to it at one point. and it was in my voice is indistinguishable. I didn't hear a deeper voice on it. So I don't mm-hmm. know. Maybe this pre-K teacher was just a pedophile.
Did you have a really deep Brooklyn accent when you were younger? I don't know what that even means. A deep Brooklyn accent. I mean, come on, you're 5 years old, so like you haven't even really developed an accent yet.
Hey, Ma, you know, let me get a hot dog and put some sauerkraut on it, because you know these guys down on the corner, they messing with me.
I'm just envisioning like one of those characters from Tiny Toon Adventures. I think it's the one who always is like fawning for Shirley the loon, the little like rooster, the baby rooster who constantly is swearing. Foulmouth, I think it's like the youth version of Foghorn Leghorn. And I can just imagine his song, just like he's just talking like this. He's just talking like this, and he like goes bleep 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 bleep, and just a constant bleep over and over and over again.
That was me as a little kid. Yeah. No, I it's funny because my parents cursed a lot more than I did when I was young.
Mm.
And I definitely like cursed, but it was so normal and so Brooklyn to be cursing. So it just wasn't, you know, it didn't have the shock value. It didn't have, to me, it was just, you know. And then I always saw people like, there was all these dudes yelling on the street all the time. So it was one of these things that when I was really young, I cursed more. But I think I was just emulating, you know, the guy at the deli. And the guy at the donut shop, and the guy at the pizza shop, and that was like, these are tough guys, yeah, you know, blah, 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 blah. I don't know, you know, doing that sort of thing.
My language was all learned from the media, through radio and television. I mean, my parents were pretty modest in their parenting. I think they treated their children with respect, and that they, at least from my understanding, didn't swear around their kids very often. But I do remember very much so whenever I think I've told the story before, my father would always find himself cursing in my presence. And at some point when I was maybe like eight or nine, when I did catch him, I would always make it a point to berate him for swearing. I always could tell when there was a bad word, and I always like just follow through for my mom and be like, you shouldn't say that, Dad. You should go to your room. And like, when you come out, I hope you have an apology ready for me.
Yeah, no, I have a friend of mine. Basically, her kid, she's Brazilian, and her husband is American, and her kid speaks both Portuguese and English.
Right.
And the kid speaks Portuguese just to the father, who doesn't speak it as well, and speaks only English to the mother, who doesn't speak English as well, just to foul them up, basically. And then makes fun of them when they don't speak the language as correct as they should.
It's like reverse psychology in some respects. Because, not everyone's going to be able to understand necessarily, no? When there's another language involved.
Portuguese is hard, man.
I don't even know how I would have been able to get away with any language. It's just an out of sight, out of mind thing, I guess. I didn't grow up speaking any other languages other than English. So my entire experience with being around kids who did have other languages that they spoke in the house, I was floored. Just a culture shock for me. Not necessarily because I was around people, you know, with different nationalities. It was just more about any language. French, Spanish, Russian, any family that had another language spoken in the house. Hebrew, and everybody spoke Hebrew more in the house, I was like, whoa, that's intense. I mean, I go to Hebrew school, but I don't speak that in the house. Whoa.
I heard this like old stat about New York that in, you know, families in New York City, only one out of every five families speaks only one language in the home.
Mm.
And, you know, the one language is not always English. I was like, that makes a lot of sense. For me, when I was a kid, my mother, her first language was Spanish. And she spoke to me only in Spanish primarily when I was a baby. And I wasn't speaking, and other children around my age were speaking. And she stopped speaking to me in Spanish because she was worried that I wouldn't learn any language at all. So I don't really speak Spanish fluently now.
Hmm.
I can speak it with like a decent accent because she yelled at me in Spanish a lot. So things like, lávate los manos or póngate en la basura, you know, these things are just...
What did you just say?
I said, wash your hands, and I said, put it in the trash.
The basics.
The basic mom stuff. Classic mom, you know, speaking in Mother's Day just recently. Happy Mother's Day to everyone.
Indeed. Happy Mother's Day, y'all.
So she never... And then she's always sort of regretted it. And I said to her afterwards, one of these days, I said, Mom, you know, you were worried about me not speaking correctly or like not learning a language, and now all I do is speak every job in my spare time.
Yeah,
all I'm
exactly.
ever, I just need a mic and I'm just trying to talk. So I said maybe it was a good thing because, you know, I've attained mastery of the English language.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. But would I have had? I don't know. She doesn't have any accent at all. She sounds totally American when she speaks.
My mother, when she was younger, I don't even think she spoke Yiddish with her grandmother, but her grandmother definitely was fluent and completely spoke in Yiddish. And even into her last days, I guess maybe it's a sort of a thing that happens. I don't know what the term is, but when you get to be of a certain age, in your last days, you just sort of revert to your first language. You don't speak any secondary languages. So for her, English was a secondary language, and she spoke entirely Yiddish until she died. And my mother, even growing up when she was living in Brooklyn, she had a relationship with her grandmother that was very great. And her language was English. Her grandmother was more or less completely, Yiddish all the time and obviously understood English. And my mother would never speak it. So it was just the perfect recipe where you completely knew what one person was saying, but you weren't speaking it in response. Which I think happens in a lot of, extended families where you could be speaking in another language and you will respond in your native language, understanding what is said. I find that completely compelling when two people could be speaking the different languages and they still know what each other are saying, but they can't speak it in, back and forth.
Actually, it's funny because my roommate, his parents speak in Spanish to him a lot, and they'll be around my apartment sometimes, and he never speaks in Spanish back. Always speaks back in English, but he always knows exactly what they're talking about.
Sure.
He never asks them, what would you say? And it's funny because I think I actually heard him even make a comment one time that he just doesn't like speaking in Spanish. Like, he knows how to, but he just doesn't enjoy it. He just likes English more. He just said, no, this is my language. I grew up in New York, so I'm not going to speak that. He said, I'm here. I'm not there. Everyone's got their perspective. I think that there's something that's really cool about language that intrinsically, culture comes from language a lot, and the way that people act, sometimes is even based upon the language that they speak. And you don't even think about how deep the roots go because they've only got words for certain things or different tenses. And one thing I heard about recently that was interesting was in Chinese, I don't know if it was Mandarin or Cantonese, but there's no indeterminate future, meaning that there's no word for later. And because there's no word for I'll get to it later, meaning I haven't planned when I'm going to do it. I do plan to do it, but I'll get to it whenever, sort of, I feel like is the implication when you say later. But they don't have a later, so either they do things right now or they actually have a planned time for something. And because of that, they said that people in China tend to be more productive in things. They're always doing more things because they feel as though they have to do it and they just can't. They don't put it off.
This is a very rudimentary clip about what languages mean to our minds when we are clearly incapable of recognizing what they really truly are. And so I bring you our debut clip for Radio Free Brooklyn's Lost and Rewound.
Bum, ba-da-dum, bum, bum.
Nate's geography lesson. This is how you say goodbye in about 5 different languages. No, how you really do it. In France, as you know from past geography lessons, you say bonjour. You have to say bonjour.
Bonjour!
Right. In Spanish, to say hello, you say hola.
Hola!
I don't know. In Hebrew, to say hello, you say shalom.
Shalom.
In what are the languages? Help me out. German? I don't know how to say it. And even though I don't know how to say hello in German, I do know how to say, do you speak German? Sprechen Sie Deutsch. This has been an edition of Nate's Geography Lesson.
Nate was always very good on the mic, as sort of the instructor for many a matter, be it geography, literature, science, math. He was a whiz.
I'm always intrigued when you hear someone, especially on one of the clips, or you'll just remember back to your own past and say, oh, remember that kid that always used to, like, take his pants off in homeroom and run around.
Yeah.
Well, now that kid is, you know, Secretary of State. And now he only takes his pants off for the Prime Minister.
Well, look, if we want to go into the whole, like, a rabbit hole of where the people are now, I mean, that's one of the reasons why this show sort of demonstrates such an interesting revelation, if you will, that, you know, when we were this age, who would have thought we would be getting to a point in our lives where this stuff is still around to look and listen back to, I should say, and be able to be a little more objective, as I'm hoping to be, about who we used to be. But, you know, it definitely is the case that a number of voices in these archives, be it mine or be it somebody else's, mean something to somebody else. And who knows if those somebody else's would be freaked out to hear that somebody actually had their voice featured.
Well, that's exactly that.
Fearless, yeah. Though. Fearless.
I always think that, think about how many things you say every day that aren't recorded.
True.
That just go out into the ether. And maybe people hear them, but chances are they won't remember them. And when you actually have your voice recorded, you know, at some point, that's gonna live on, you know. And I think that's something that you know, people love about art the same way. They can create this thing, and now it's out in the world. People say, you know, tattooers, they're always excited because they can, you know, put their art on these living canvases, right, on people's skin, and then their art gets shown all around every place this person travels to. Their art gets to travel to,
yeah,
as well.
Well, it's kind of like a passport in some respects too. No, it's like a passport on your body.
Yeah.
This is where I've been.
Exactly.
Check it out.
Exactly. So it's just this, but I think that that's sort of an interesting thing, because when you do tattoos, they have an expiration date, you know, whenever that person dies. But the audio tape, unless at some point there's no more way to be able to play those 8 tracks, you know?
Correct.
They're, you know, people can listen to this stuff that this show we created, someone could listen to this 200 years from now and be like, the hell are these guys talking about?
Exactly. Because we're actually in the specialty of covering a medium that in and of itself is become so obscure that really, well, they're thinking to themselves, like, I'm all about those tapes. Oh, man.
Tape jockey. Yeah,
exactly.
Just killing it. Boombox, like, oh, yo, watch this. Blam. Like, I got this new cassette.
Truth be told, it's definitely a fixed medium of which a very specific type of individual, be it audio file or archivist like myself, that's what I'm really in search for. But, you know, it's exciting to be able to have such an uncharted territory in our disposal of, like, what other kind of projects were people working on. How many other crazy people are like me?
We need to find them.
My friend Brooks Rocco and I were essentially the tag team of the Danziger Zone, and we came up with this rather insane little ditty, kind of like a soap opera, if you will. Let's take a listen.
Now it's time for As the Ball Bounces. Today on As the Ball Bounces, Mr. Scarlett O'Hara bounces on top of the ball. Hey, bounce, you stupid ball. Did you hear that? I don't know if you did. There you go. This has been As the Ball Bounces.
Ingenious.
So just that kind of example, just really, it's to the point. It's very specific, I guess, but just awesome to be able to know that you can do anything and creating little silly plays or, you know, of that kind of nature, I think is really kind of the sweet spot for what you would imagine any kid would want to do with a tape. They just would want to make funny voices or try and play with sound effects.
There's something deeper into As the Ball Bounces. Like,
let's dissect.
There's something more to this.
As the ball bounces.
when I first heard that clip, it spoke to me. I don't know what it was, but I was like,
it's just,
man, that ball. I want to know more. I just, like, where did that ball come from? Where is it going?
Where is it going? Is the best idea. It's just the ball. it, where did it come from? Was it in a storage shed? Where, you know, what else is in that storage shed?
Just, I mean, how many times has it bounced?
It sounded like, it didn't even sound like a basketball. And I had a basketball.
Maybe, I think it might have been like a, one of those kickball, dodgeball kind of balls.
Probably, like probably.
If I had to listen to the quality of the ball, when it was bouncing on the ground and bouncing off of the record, it sounded rubbery.
What kind of like recreational sports did you play? Not in school, but just like on your own. Did you like do the stickball or the kickball or the?
I think that
trick ball.
Yo, trick balling.
Trick balling.
I think I'm a little sad because when I was a kid, we were like just past the stickball era. Like,
okay,
it was gone.
That was your dad's thing.
Yeah, they played stickball like a mug. Seriously, like played a lot of stickball. And I always wanted to. We did play, like, wiffle ball sometimes, but that was, like, because it was definitely a pussy version of stickball.
Wait, what? Really? Wiffle ball?
You could get hit in the head with a line drive, and, like, you would just look like an idiot.
Okay, how old are we talking, though, for wiffle ball?
Oh, I don't know. We were, like, 8 or 9 or 10.
Come on. That's not a big deal. Wiffle ball is fair.
I mean, it was fun, and if somebody was like, yo, let's go play some wiffle ball right now, mm-hmm. I would be down.
You never played kickball, though.
No, I definitely played kickball, and I was an absolute beast at kickball. Like, if anybody wants to throw on the gauntlet, and, like, I haven't played in, like, a decade, and I will pull out the skills, I'm telling you. I don't know why. I think with kickball, and I was trying to think about this. I don't know why. Sometimes I come and I think about, like, really important things like the tactics you need necessary to win kickball and, like, why someone would ever become a bathroom attendant. Like, these are things that really make me
– yeah.
They really started to get me thinking. And I thought a lot about kickball. It actually goes back to this one instance I had of playing. And I think it was the last game I ever played at kickball. So it was this crowning moment. So it was actually – I had been in the school play in high school. It was Midsummer Night's Dream. And I played Demetrius. And
But you told the story where when you like pants the kid, right?
Yeah, that was from the same play.
That was from the same
play. Same play.
There's another story within this illustrious play.
This play
changed everything.
It was amazing, man. Everyone that was involved with it equally was like, that was just one of the most amazing moments.
I didn't mean to cut you off though about that. I didn't realize you were.
No, you're right though. You're right. If you haven't heard yet, that in that play. In one of the performances, I pants the other main actor without telling him.
I think you talked about that the last time you were on the show before you ventured off into the hills.
I vanished.
You talked. That was like one of the last things you talked about.
Yeah, and he had like heart boxers on too. It was like perfect, but I didn't tell him. I pantsed him. He got really surprised, and then it really added to his performance.
Yep.
And he thanked me afterwards because he knew it was really great. He told me never to do it again, but he was like, that was really cool.
I'd imagine that's something
the director afterward. The director yelled at me in front of the whole cast, and then he pulled me aside too and was like, no, that was awesome.
But what was the other thing?
So the other story was after the play was over, it was sort of a big deal that I'd gotten cast because I actually had the most lines in the play. Because I was enough of a ego-driven person to count.
Sure.
So, because I had a feeling I did, and I didn't really know why, because my character definitely wasn't the main character. If you haven't seen Midsummer Night's Dream, Demetrius is sort of like the rich, pompous jerk.
Whereas Lysander is just like...
Yeah. So I was like, I definitely did it really goofy and funny, and I tried to be sort of like, Beauty and the Beast? What's that guy's name in the...
You're putting me on the spot, dude.
I don't know what I'm talking about. That guy...
Gaston?
Gaston.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you knew.
Sorry.
I did Gaston, but lighter. I did like Gaston. That was sort of like my inspiration.
You did a less demeaning version of Gaston.
Because you know how you kind of like... Gaston's kind of a jerk, but you think he's funny?
You did a feminist version of Gaston.
But then he tries to murder the beast, and you're like, all right, fuck this guy.
Exactly.
You're like, nah.
Correct.
I'm done. Like, at that point, you give up on him. But before that, You kind of don't, you know, he's just a little bit abusive and you're like, okay, like that song in the beginning really had me.
Yeah, exactly.
So I did mine and it was sort of similar. Like he's like a little handsy. it was goofy. It was a big deal that I got in that role because I'd never done a school play before. And like other actors in the play were pissed because, I don't know, they worked through the ranks of freshman year or whatever to get there. They did their time in background roles, right?
Right.
So I got cast in like, and then I did really, really well. And like, I was like, became one of the stars of the show, and people really liked my jokes. And I like, it made me popular in school. It was like a whole thing. Anyway, we had the cast party afterwards. And I don't know for what reason, the director, who was just like the coolest guy, shout outs to Quinn Strassel, wherever you are. That guy was the man. He used to listen to Strokes. We'd listen to Strokes in class sometimes when people were getting too rowdy.
Right on.
But we played kickball. And it was just this one game. And there was only two people who got home runs during the game. And it was me and the director, Quinn Strassel.
And he was
on my team. He picked me, and he like winked at me before the game started. I don't know how he knew I had kickball skills. He did his research.
And then Susie Dressler looked at the two of you and was like, "I can't choose between them." As the ball bounces.
Well, I'll tell you, it was as the ball bounces. After I kicked that ball,
yes.
Because when you get a, have you ever hit a home run in kickball before?
No, that's a putting on the spot. I don't think I ever, maybe like an infield home run.
You could have gotten, I mean, in my opinion, for kickball, that counts. Because you should be able, some people can't field, but that ball is so big, you got to be able to field.
I'm going to go with no.
But you remember those times when you were playing and one kid kicked it and it just went so far and nobody knew what to do and he just jogged around the bases.
Yeah, it wasn't me. I was just happy to even be playing at all in the first place and even getting a base hit.
I like that you can bunt and kick ball, too. That was always funny. You know, some people just lay off the little bunt and try to squirm down the line. You know, it took me years to perfect it, and I figured it out one time, how to kick it perfectly, the sweet spot of the ball, and kick a home run. And it would be skied. It would be, like, going towards, like, the sun. And everyone would just look, and even the outfielders were, like, slowly jog to it.
Was the field, the ring, I don't know, I guess the diamond, if you will? I don't know exactly if you have to equate all terminology.
Was it regulation baseball size?
Yes. Did you have bleachers? No. Well, I was actually wondering where it was in comparison to the school. So, like, when you hit a home run, did it go away from the school or did it go towards the school?
So, our school didn't have a field. So, we had to go to this field in the neighborhood.
Okay.
It was like a public park.
I was going to accept, like concrete, like a sort of blacktop within the playground area of your school.
No, it was actually like a lot of schools used to use it, and it was just like a baseball diamond in Bay Ridge.
Got it.
I want to say, no, it wasn't Owl's Head Park, but it was somewhere close to that. But I'm telling you, man, I hit that home run in that kickball game as the ball bounces. My legend was born. Like, it was glorious. It was glorious.
Yeah, a legend was created that day.
I'm telling you.
And thus another storyline as well.
Right? You know? I wish I could get that moment back, trotting around those bases.
Dude, there's something really special about sports when you actually do something right. And, you know, I mentioned basketball. The moment for me, the sports moment that I had for me, that Rudy moment, I guess you can call it.
Rudy!
Was, because I was playing basketball ever since I was in fifth grade. It was the sport that I felt most comfortable playing on my own. I had a hoop in my driveway, on my gravel driveway, of which was not at all the right space physically to have a hoop, because it was just, the bounce was not as good as it would have been if it was just like a straight paved court. If I wanted that, I would have had to go into town. I did not. I didn't want to embarrass myself in front of a ton of my peers, and much less have to ask one of my folks to drive me into town. So I just made do with this dinky little hoop in my driveway that collected rust over the years. And when I was in high school, I got to be on the basketball team somehow. Somehow, more or less as a bench warmer. I did do it in middle school and had a more or less a negative experience with that. And then I tried it again for some reason because I'm a total, masochist, evidently.
Glutton for punishment.
Yeah, exactly. But I was more or less a glorified bench warmer in 11th and 12th grade. And somehow, in 12th grade, I managed to score a three-point shot at a game that wasn't actually a regulation game. It was a junior varsity game or something. Like, somehow we still counted it anyway, but the whatever the fact was that the team that we were playing was not in our division, so it didn't actually count as much as it was more or less it was just like an exhibition game of sorts. And so in my senior year, I've never scored a point at all in any of these games, and the only point I ever made was a three-pointer, and everybody went crazy. Like, it got written up in the yearbook. I couldn't believe it. They called it the E3.
That's amazing.
That was actually my nickname throughout all of my basketball career. Right?
Dude, can I just call you E3 from now on? That's amazing.
It's not copyrighted as far as I'm concerned.
Dude, E3, dude. I love it.
Let's take a quick break on that note. Just a quick segue, and then we will return with more clips.
This is Jimmy and E3 for Lost and Rewound.
Riding on the bus all the time with kids who were younger than you was always sort of a pain in the ass, especially when your sibling was there. And my sister, I just sort of ignored her to the best of my abilities. You think we both rode the bus a lot? Yeah, you rode the bus. We talked about that.
Oh, yeah. I was cheese bussing for sure.
And when you get to a certain age, you become happy to be the senior bus rider. Like, you are the king. And we've covered that a lot in Lost and Rewound in episodes past of the podcast version. It was something that was wonderful when you got to that point where you were an upperclassman, more or less, and the first graders, the second, third, fourth, fifth, nobody can touch you. You were God. You were golden. You were unstoppable. And so Brooks in that clip just emulates the fantastic ideas that come about when you are left with no fifth graders. Like, you don't look at the fourth and under with disdain, but the grade below you is like, gone. Yes! Finally!
You know, this is something that when you get older, you still have to go through, like, difficult challenges and tasks in your life. But there's something about when you're a kid, the immediacy of the next thing you have to undertake. When you're going to ride the bus, you're in that moment of riding the bus. I never thought about what is my bus ride going to be like tomorrow, or what is my bus ride going to be like later this week. It was that day's bus ride, and that was like the moment. And it was every day like that.
Sure.
And everything was just like every moment when you're young, it just carries a lot more weight. And I know what you mean. Like, something so small. Remember when you were a kid and, like, you had a trip and you felt just invincible? Like, you weren't carrying a backpack and no one could stop you now.
No, of course not. Of course not. Dude, like, even staying over, going to, like, a sleepover or something that you just sort of expected that. But it was like when you stayed over at a non-friend's house, when you were anywhere away for a long period of time and you went away to a sleepaway camp, it was daunting just being away and being away from the house for any long period of time that wasn't familiar. That was a real pisser to do that.
I think for me, when I had to, did I ever talk about Boy Scouts at all on the show?
Maybe not.
Yeah,
I want to hear about that.
I was a Boy Scout.
All of it's juicy.
I know. Like, it's one of these things where I was in a paramilitary youth organization.
Yeah.
I was thinking about recently that if this was Nazi Germany, me being in Boy Scouts would have just been Hitler Youth.
Well, you know what? We're not there, and let's not jinx it, okay?
I thought about that recently, and I'm like, that's sort of terrifying.
Let's appreciate the liberties that we have and had.
So in this beautiful country that we live in, America. These glorious markers, these glorious United States.
Yes.
I was a Boy Scout. And I got to first class, which sounds better than it actually is.
Okay.
So I was a Cub Scout, too. I went through the whole Cub Scout thing. Past, there's, like, Wolf, which sounds awesome, but it's, like, the worst one. Then Bobcat's the lowest. It goes Bobcat, Wolf, Bear, Weeblow. Then when you get into regular Scouts, there's, like, Scout. And then there's, like, Second Class and First Class and Star and Heart. Like, it starts to turn into, like, Captain Planet. And you get all the way to Eagle Scout. People have heard of Eagle Scouts before, you know.
Sure.
Which you can put on apparently a college application. It's such a big deal.
Until only up to some point, no.
I don't
know. Or forever.
I know that, like, when you
stamp it on your resume.
To become an Eagle Scout, you had to, like, organize, like, some sort of charity event where you had to raise, like, a certain amount of money. Like, it was really, really hard. I remember looking at the qualifications for it, and I was like, I'm going to stop four ranks before that. Because I'm going to know him. I know my place. But I went to Boy Scout camp, which was really cool, with the exception that there's no girls there. And then it would be sort of funny because in a way you had this, like, prison aspect where every once in a while, like, one girl would walk through camp.
Civilization!
And everyone in there would be like, hooting, like, ooh, come on, sweetheart, get it over here! It was like kids.
But, like, sounding exactly like that.
But it'd be really great if, like, the kids had, like, you know, spiderwebs tattooed on their head. And then
teardrops for every stick that they managed to get into the
exactly
or whatever they made
you
do.
It's my swastika merit badge,
dude.
Let's go right back to it.
Jimmy is in no way condoning Nazism.
I'm not, but a lot of my jokes will come back to it.
It'll be a reoccurring theme.
No, that's going to happen. If you haven't seen Hogan's Heroes, check it out. You know, that's where my head is at. But basically, this long, long story is just getting to the fact that since it was Boy Scouts, they're like, well, you're going to live a little bit more rugged than, you know, regular campers would. So you're just going to be sleeping on bunks on a wood deck. And the wood deck's just going to have flaps that hang off the side like you're in military installation somewhere. So we did that. During the day, you're like, oh, this is like whatever, you know, ooh, it's a little brisk, and, you know, you're a little colder when you get in your little sleeping bag at night. But then throughout the night, you kind of realize that you're just outside. You're not in the tent. You're in this open thing that's just got these tarps flapping down. I want to say, and I hope, I only saw raccoons, but I definitely saw shadows moving by that were small. You know, little husky animals and stuff moving around. I heard animals walking over the deck while we were sleeping. And then you would wake up with so many insects in your bed. It was nuts.
I think that was the thing that just turned me off from camping ultimately in the first place.
I couldn't
call
believe
me a
it.
Ninny, but man.
No, isn't it? That's that. This is the whole reason I started telling the story, was to get to bed full of insects. Because it's exactly that. I think it takes a certain kind of person, especially if you come from civilization. When you do get into a situation where you're in a bed full of insects, it's alarming.
It's like we grow up to finally be New Yorkers and pay a shitload of rent, and we don't want to be finding ants or roaches or, God forbid, bed bugs in our beds. We don't want bugs.
We don't want no bugs.
We don't want no bugs. If we wanted them, we'd go camping.
Yeah.
Sorry, but it's just kind of the way it is.
I went there for 2 weeks only, I think it was. And I went there a couple years in a row. But the first year, I really hated the Bucks. And I remember I called up, like, my dad or my mom or someone, and I was like, I was ready to back it in. I was just like, I'm not. This is just nope.
This is too much. This is like, traumatizing.
You wake up, you've got like a bug like on your eye. And you're like, you open your eyelid, and like the bug is like, it's like daddy long legs, and it's like straddling you. Well,
yeah, I mean, they're gross, but they're not going to do anything to
they're
you.
They're not going to. No, all the bugs that I found in my bed, nothing was going to do anything to me.
They're like the most harmless. They're just there to kill the things that you hate, actually.
It's true. But it was just one of those things. But I'll tell you, by the end of the 2 weeks, I was like Rambo. Like I would wake up in the morning and like grab the bugs and squish them in my hand and like, you know, get up a knife and start sharpening it by the fire. And like, and it culminated. I had this really big fear because, so the way that the deck was it was just a wooden deck and then the flaps hung down on the sides and then there was no front flaps at all and there was no back flaps. So just side flaps. There was like this center beam, this column above us, above our heads. And then, it hung down the flaps over the side. But on that center column was just so many bugs that we couldn't get to. It was just too tall even for an adult to do anything about. And if you looked up, it looked like a couple hundred spiders that were just like gathered on it. Ugh. And then we went into other people's bunks, and they had no spiders. There was no spider colony. But our bunk definitely had a spider colony. So come and you bring this to people's attention, and it's Boy Scouts, so they usually tell you, buck up.
Yeah.
They have this very tough attitude about stuff. You would think, you know, you don't think it's like that, but it's to the point like when I was going to learn how to swim, I was like the only guy in my troop that didn't know how to swim. To get to the next rank, we were trying to get everybody up at the same time. Like I needed to know how to swim. So me and my scoutmaster were standing on the end of this deck by a lake and he goes, "Get in." And it was too deep. I knew I was like, I couldn't get footing in it. And I was terrified. I didn't know how to swim. And I was like, I don't know. And he grabbed my wrist and he spun in a circle with me like as fast as he could. And he chucked me in the lake.
Wow.
And I swam back to the dock. And ever since then, I knew how to swim. Like, it was crazy. It was like, you know. And then I remember because I was drowning. And I was like, why would you do this to me? And then he was looking at me and he gave me this like super intense look. And it was just like, do it.
The being in the water part was never for me the thing I hated. But that sounds like just the most like traumatizing thing ever.
No, man, you know,
it's for me if it was just going into the cold. That was the part that I just would never look forward to. Is I would delay my jumping in because I didn't like how cold the water was. It wasn't the swimming part. It was more just the fear of the chill that always killed me.
You know what it was? When he did it, I never really got mad at him because to me, I just sort of treated it like a Karate Kid sort of thing. This is what I needed. He knew that I wasn't going to do it.
Right.
And he just decided to kick my ass. And then I learned, and I was fine after that. It was one of those hard-nosed things, but sometimes that stuff works. It depends. Like, I'm not advocating that you come and you raise your children, you know, and give them, like, you know, the stern hand because mm-hmm. you're going to teach them all sorts of lessons. I always sort of thought it was just like a challenge. He just challenged me. And he was right there. So, you know, if I really went under, he could have just jumped in and grabbed me. But yeah, maybe I could have drowned. You never know. It's dangerous, you know. And then the case starts. What's the statute of limitations on trying to drown a kid, right?
Oh my goodness. We have time for one more clip, and I think what we'll do is we'll just roll this and there's no real easy way to segue from talking about drowning to talking about the blues. Let's take a listen.
And here's the debut of Chris Bailey, the big man himself.
All right, so we're sitting in the car, cruising downtown Kingston, listening to John Mayall playing the blues. Now, the blues is real music. It's real music. It's not your rap or your trash.
It's real music for old farts.
Excuse me. What's real music?
Bill isn't a rap.
When I'm rapping with my friends on the street corner, doing drugs and not what we order.
Well, I like alternatives. Yeah. Java, dude.
I like alternatives. Whatever that means. I don't know. Kyle was one of my good friends growing up whose sister was also good friends with my sister. So Cassie and Sarah, Kyle and I always had sort of like these double sleepover play dates basically. And Kyle's dad was this very outspoken British guy who would drive us to the movies. He was, you know, very, very charismatic fellow and would always be listening to blues music in the car. And it was always a source of contention with him and his son. And I managed to get that on tape where, you know, I was able to actually record Chris schooling us about the blues.
That was I really like his attitude, you know. It's really funny. I was just thinking about that recently, this idea of how not always, and it depends, I think, a lot on the culture too, but it depends on who you are. Sometimes people will listen to the music that their parents listen to,
right,
or sometimes they'll like despise it and really like be angry almost at the parents, and their parents the same way won't legitimize the music that they listen to. One thing that my father, he personally, he can't hear rap. Like, when rap is playing, he just can't decipher what they're saying.
Oh, okay. I was about to say, like, has he, like, conditioned his mind to not be able to listen to it?
I try to help him condition his mind to hear it because, you know, he's an old-time Brooklyn guy, so mm-hmm. he comes and he makes the same joke every time you see him. Like, if you bring up rap, he's got his classic joke that he says, and he says, because he dislikes two types of music, or I guess maybe three. Because he always will talk about how he used to wear, like, all these shirts about hating disco in the 70s. So he dislikes disco.
Right.
But current music, he dislikes country and he dislikes rap. So he always goes, he always says, yeah, did you hear that country music and rap music are going to fuse soon? They're going to call it crap.
One for the books.
You know, and I personally probably listen to rap more than any other type of music at this point in my life.
But did you when you were younger, though?
Nope. I started listening to it in college.
You didn't listen to it until you got into college.
Yeah.
That was the same thing with me. A little before college, but more or less college was when I really began to cultivate my rap listening skills and educate myself. But dude, like, I remember reading a thing in Spin magazine. For full disclosure, I subscribed to Rolling Stone, Spin, Details, a few magazines. I looked at the Spin list of, like, the greatest albums of the 90s or something, and De La Soul is Dead and Low End Theory by A Tribe Called Quest were on there, and I bought those albums as soon as I could. For some reason, like, there was just something about seeing these two groups on the list of whom I had been familiarized with just through mentioning, and I was like, if I'm going to get rap albums, I'm going to get these because these clearly represent a true era of which I am not educated with. But, like, it was around high school, around certainly before college, but gosh, you know, when I was like 11, 12 years old, I think my entire exposure to rap was just like Coolio and Naughty by Nature and maybe some other artist that I can't recall right now. Montel Jordan doesn't count.
I definitely like Coolio.
Onyx.
I definitely like Coolio. I'm not going to front. That hairdo, too. I remember being a kid and liking Coolio, but I never really listened to rap. And it's funny, actually, because my reason for not listening to rap, New York, racialized, deep-seated reason for why I didn't listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so for those of you who don't know, I can't remember anything, but I don't know if I've mentioned before on the program that I'm multiracial. So my father is, I want to say, he's German, Russian, and my mother is Puerto Rican.
Your father is Brooklyn.
He's Brooklyn, straight up, old time Brooklyn. See you on the street corner. I know, but
country, rap music, crap. It's all crap.
But I think when I was growing up, and I talk about this a lot in my comedy too, that I had this struggle of identity because there was, and it's not as much anymore, but still when I was growing up, it was a big deal. Like, the way you acted was like racially driven. So you would fit in. There weren't cliques when I was in high school. There were races. And, you know, everyone hung out with their own kind.
Yeah.
It was your own kind. And it wasn't like you couldn't be friends with anyone else, but it was just the way things were.
Were kids listening to the blues back then?
Not a soul. The blues, I heard from John Taffer on Bar Rescue that the blues is dead. and only 2% of Americans listen.
So you're gonna you're just gonna pay attention to TV now? Like that's
where I get all my facts.
That's
from.
Where you get your facts from.
Yeah.
That's where I got. That's where 11-year-old Alon got his facts from.
Oh yeah, books. No.
I just didn't have a concept about the blues at all when I was a kid, so I just assumed that because if none of the other kids were into it, then I probably didn't have any say in it. I didn't have any real individual taste until I started really getting out of the box that was Woodstock and moving to more different flavors of Poughkeepsie Day, which we'll talk about the next time, I suppose. It was very much such a diverse school in that with all the kids that were there, they all came from different backgrounds, albeit rich ones, but also having a sort of a different lay of the land in, you know, what they were accustomed to, what they were exposed to. I guess maybe it was because I was around high schoolers as opposed to just kids who were my age. I was around a smaller contingent of kids, so I was able to connect on a more personal level with those of whom were the upperclassmen. And it was interesting because, you know, whereas you were saying your student body, you know, the way people connected were that of more of a racial, I would say I connected people with more on like what we listened to musically or like what we watched. You know, you connected with people just based on your tastes. I don't know. Like that's the way I felt.
Yeah.
And like I was listening to Soul Asylum and Alanis Morissette, so I had no friends when I first got to Poughkeepsie Day.
I think at that point in high school I was listening to metal and alternative rock, which are two things that don't really go together.
Chili Peppers. I was listening to a lot of Chili Peppers in middle school.
So like the Hives. You know?
Yeah.
Like the same with Strokes before. But the thing was that I didn't feel like I had legitimacy to listen to rap because I had this idea that it was music that was not created for me. There are plenty, like, for instance, Lauryn Hill.
Right.
Came out and said she didn't like white people listening to music.
Okay, right? Well, that's her opinion.
It is, exactly. So it was one of these things where, you know, I heard something like that, and then I'd hear instances where people would go like, man, white people would be stealing our music, man. You know, like, stuff like that. And I was only half white, but it was enough that I was like, oh, I don't want to be one of those people, you know, that's stepping on your toes.
Right.
I didn't immediately speak to me. You know, when I was growing up as a kid, the criminal life was all around me. And I personally
equated it?
You know, I just said, well, I'm not, you know, in out of prison and stuff, or, you know, where a lot of the gangster rap was in the 90s. But then I got a little older and I started listening to all underground rap, where they were rapping more about stuff that I could identify with. Like,
yeah, it was the same with me.
Like Fantastic Four.
Wait, were you talking about like Doom or what?
Yeah, Doom.
Yeah, exactly. Fair
that
enough.
Was like, I think Doom was the guy, MF Doom.
Yeah.
Check him out. If they really
or his kinda, many different aliases.
Yeah, Metal Face. He kind of pushed me into it. Where now I listen to it a lot. That and Motown. So I sort of changed my whole thing around. I don't listen to
wrong with Motown.
I don't listen to any more white people music. You know?
Hey,
had to retire that.
It came full circle.
Exactly.
Folks, we got to wrap up. And I don't know why I just pluralized. You're our listener. Thank you, listener. One listener out there listening to us. We are here on Radio Free Brooklyn every Thursday afternoon from 3 to 4 p.m. If you have anything you want to submit for us to listen to and come on the show to talk about it, email us, lostandrewound@gmail.com.
And again, from everybody here at Radio Free Brooklyn, tune in next time for another episode of Lost and Rewound.
Peace.
I hear some hip-hop. Uh-huh.